Hi there. Welcome back to Health Law Diagnosed, a Mint podcast dedicated to health law, health policy, and social issues in the healthcare industry. I'm Bridget Keller, your podcast host. Joining me today are two of my colleagues from the health law practice, Joanne Hawana, member in our Washington, D.C. office, and Ben Zangarelli of counsel in our New York office. Joanne and Ben are experts in FDA, offering strategic advice and counseling to our clients on a variety of FDA regulatory issues. And specifically, they have been following the regulatory requirements related to lab-developed tests, or LDTs, for quite some time. I asked Joanne and Ben to join me today to talk to you a little bit about the FDA's long-awaited proposed rules that came out at the end of last year. And these proposed rules will actively regulate LDTs, which, as we will discuss, have historically not been subject to significant regulatory oversight. Joanne, Ben, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely, Bridget, and thanks for having us.
First off, why don't we start by getting into the background? What is a lab-developed test?
Yeah, so got to set the groundwork before we talk about the actual proposed rule here. But a lab-developed test is a specific type of in vitro diagnostic test, so or an IVD. So let's talk about the IVD class first, and then we can talk about how an LDT is distinguished. So an in vitro diagnostic test is typically a test that uses any sort of biological specimen and then is taken to a laboratory or might be used, analyzed within a kit to analyze specific markers or, you know, enzymes, proteins, genetic code, anything within that specimen to sort of identify something about it. And usually that means, you know, identifying the presence of something, which could indicate illness or condition. And many times, like I said, these are tests that are conducted in laboratories with lots of different types of reagents, or could be part of a kit with all the reagents and supplies that is sold to a laboratory or a doctor's office, or even directly to a consumer to use at home. But then when we talk about lab-developed tests, we're talking about a very specific subset of IVDs. So FDA has defined an LDT as an IVD that is designed, manufactured, and used within a single laboratory that is CLIA certified for high complexity testing. So this means that it has to be developed and used within a clinical laboratory that is specifically licensed by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under CLIA, and it can't be sold directly to consumers. There has to be a physician order involved in order to be an LDT. Joanne, anything else to add to that? Did I catch everything?
Yeah, that's about the extent of it, Ben. A good summary of what an LDT is.
So that's really interesting. Is the key difference there that the LDT has to be run in that one particular laboratory that holds the license?
Yeah, so that's the big difference. LDTs are specifically limited to tests that are, you know, where everything is designed, even specific custom reagents are designed within that laboratory, and then the test itself has to be run completely within that laboratory. So if the lab tries to branch out and extend its test and have other labs perform it, it then becomes not an LDT because the test has to be, you know, in FDA's definition, it has to be sort of unique, right? It has to be designed and run all within the same lab. So if there's a branch out to like an affiliate lab, it actually breaks that identification of that test as an LDT.
That's so interesting, Ben. So where do LDTs sit from a regulatory perspective? Is it just under that one CLIA license? And is that the extent of oversight?
So yeah, it's a bit complicated because as IVDs, LDTs are technically considered medical devices under FDA's regulatory purview. But FDA has taken the position for a number of decades that it will apply enforcement discretion to LDTs, meaning that FDA says we can regulate these tests, but we are deciding not to enforce the rules as they might apply to LDTs. So it's sort of a broad exception that FDA has applied to LDTs. And so just the way that clinical labs work and that LDTs come out of clinical labs that are certified under CLIA, the only real, you know, regulatory checks on LDTs for the past number of decades have been from CLIA and from CMS.
And Bridget, if I could maybe jump in, as Ben knows, one of my personal interests is kind of the FDA history. So I think some history might be useful here for your listeners and for you. So as Ben described, FDA has essentially been hands-off for several decades, right? When a test meets those criteria, you know, designed, manufactured, and used within a single CLIA-certified laboratory. The way that that came about is that the Food and Drug Act was amended in 1976 to explicitly authorize FDA to regulate medical devices. Prior to that, there was a little bit of device regulation, but it was not as clear. So Congress in 1976 amended the act. And at that time, FDA, in surveying the industry, the clinical field, and what was happening in medicine, what they saw was essentially lab-developed tests that were relatively simple, right? Again, it's the 70s. So, you know, there people are testing for a single analyte, you know, a protein, cholesterol, you know, things like that. And even through the 80s and 90s, as people started testing for maybe a single gene, you know, we know that there's a highly penetrant gene. If you have it, you're going to get this disease. So the tests, even in the 80s and 90s, were relatively simple. What has happened in the intervening decades is that obviously medicine has advanced exponentially. Technology has advanced exponentially. And what they're seeing now is mostly not that, right? Of course, in an academic medical center, in a hospital, there's still those simple tests being run. But what a lot of the marketplace is now for LDTs are highly complex tests. They're using instrumentation, algorithms, software. So there's a lot of concerns that the government has regarding the shift that has occurred over the last few decades. And so that's what's playing in here as well.
That's so interesting. And how did the industry generally, how do the stakeholders react to this, right? So it seems like the FDA is catching up, saying, all right, we have to do some oversight here, which we're going to talk about, you know, what's their current, like the proposed regulation, what are they proposing to do and what would be different? But what are the industry stakeholders saying about this?
Well, so I'll start with how the IVD manufacturers are responding to FDA's proposed rule, because there's a lot of focus on how the lab industry is responding, but I just want to talk first about how the traditional IVD manufacturers are reacting. So these are the manufacturers that are clearly regulated by FDA. They've had to design and manufacture their devices in compliance with FDA's quality system regulations, and they've had to follow the rules all along, get their devices cleared or approved, or if they're class one, they're exempt, but then they would still have to register their facility and then list their IVDs with the agency. So these are the companies that have been following the rules the whole time, and they've been clearly applicable. And, you know, the IVD manufacturers were sort of getting a little frustrated that FDA wasn't trying to apply its regulations to LDTs when clearly now, as Joanne mentioned, as LDTs have been getting more and more sophisticated, they've been in direct competition with IVDs that are regulated and actively regulated by FDA. And so the IVD manufacturers have been saying, hey, FDA, you know, you've said you regulate LDTs, but you're still choosing not to, even after the risks that are related to LDTs now are clearly just as much, if not more, than what apply to our products as IVDs that are regulated under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and FDA's regulations. So generally, the IVD industry, the device industry, has been responding positively to FDA's proposed rule, saying, you know, it's about time that FDA removed this enforcement discretion and decided to step in and do something about it. And then for that matter, there's a good number of healthcare professionals and laboratory directors, even who had been part of the development of LDTs, and also a number of patients that wrote in comments to the proposed rule saying, this is really necessary. We need FDA to step in and monitor the development and the manufacture and use of these LDTs to make them more comparable in risk and clinical accuracy and validity, and make them comparable to IVDs that are regulated in that way. Now, on the flip side, clinical laboratories have responded by essentially saying that FDA has no place to step in here. And you know, their primary arguments have essentially been that the FDA doesn't have the authority under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act to regulate laboratory developed tests, because essentially they're saying that the act doesn't give FDA clear authority over clinical laboratories and their activities, that authority was delegated to CMS under CLIA. And so yeah, another one of the arguments is that FDA doesn't have the capacity to review all of these tests and doesn't have the resources to do this efficiently or effectively. So what they would prefer, what the clinical laboratories would prefer, is a sort of additional oversight by CMS and maybe CAP or one of the other accrediting organizations that can take on the added responsibility of reviewing each LDT, as well as reviewing the practices at the laboratory facility as a whole. And I'll let Joanne jump in here to offer her perspective on this one.
No, that's exactly right, Ben. As you described it, there are different stakeholders and different views on this, proposal by FDA, but I think you captured it really well.
It's so fascinating. I mean, there are so many interesting areas of health law, and this is what I love so much about it, right? There's this little niche, and it grew, and it was sort of unregulated, but there's a little niche of people, and like there's half of the group who have always had to follow the rules because they were under the medical device regime and they fell there. And you have the other half of the stakeholders, the industry, is saying, well, we're labs, we're regulated by this other governing body. But the technology in healthcare advanced so much and so significantly that now here we're at a crossroads and we're saying, okay, what's the agency going to do? So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? What do the proposed rules say?
Well, they don't say much, actually, Bridget, right? At this point, they literally only say that FDA is amending the existing definition of in vitro diagnostic, IVD, that's in the regulations, in the Code of Federal Regulations, to add a clause that says, I should probably have the exact language, but essentially including IVDs made in a single lab.
Yeah, it's 10 words that they've added to the definition of IVD, which is, the 10 words are, including when the manufacturer of these products is a laboratory. That's
there you
it.
Go. Yeah. So the upshot would be that the existing statutory and regulatory requirements for medical devices and IVDs in particular would clearly extend to lab developed tests, or as Ben said, IVDs that are made in a single laboratory. That's the upshot of this small amendment they're making with the current proposal. They will have to promulgate some additional, they'll have to make changes to other regulations afterwards. But for now, that's what's in the October 2023 proposed rule. The bulk of this publication of the Federal Register, Bridget, is essentially FDA's justification for it. A lot of what we've talked about today, right? What are the policy reasons for it? What is FDA's view of the authorizing legislation and how it clearly does give them authority to regulate LDTs? They respond to what they already know are the clinical lab industry's opposition positions here that Ben described for us. So they respond to that in the preamble. So really, it's more of a policy document, if you want to think of it that way, right? It's FDA essentially putting forth its position here and almost readying itself for the litigation that they know is coming. The clinical lab industry has very clearly signaled that they will be suing the agency when this rule is finalized, on the grounds that Ben said, their view that the act does not give FDA this authority. And of course, we've had a shift in some jurisprudence in the last decade that may give them a stronger argument than maybe they would have had before. So that will be interesting to watch play out. But we certainly do expect litigation around this final rule.
I also just want to point out that it's the simplicity of the rule, the proposed rule, that has really, you know, led to sort of the ire of the clinical laboratory industry, because it's just this 10-word addition to a definition, which essentially just says, okay, now all diagnostic tests developed within a laboratory are considered medical devices, which immediately means that all the regulations that FDA has developed for medical devices and IVDs suddenly become applicable to LDTs. Now, of course, there's a phase-in period for the rule, so it won't immediately become applicable, but the definition just encompasses all LDTs and just brings them right under the current regulatory framework for medical devices in general. And so this is not what the clinical laboratory industry thought they were going to get, because they had been working hand in hand with Congress and their industry associations on legislation called the Verifying Accurate Leading Edge IVCT Development Act, or the VALID Act. And that legislation was going to create a whole separate framework for the regulation of both IVDs and LDTs outside of the current framework for just general medical devices. It was going to be mostly the same, but there were going to be some key differences. And so the industries had been working with Congress on this legislation for a number of years now, and the VALID Act has been introduced and reintroduced a few times now, but there hasn't really been any real progress on it. And so FDA saw that VALID was probably not going to come to fruition. And so FDA made clear, they said, we think LDTs are a really serious risk to public health and to patients. And so we're going to step in. We're going to step in and regulate this ourselves if Congress isn't going to legislate and bring the VALID Act to completion. So that's what FDA did. And they just did it by this 10-word amendment. So FDA didn't establish a whole different structure for LDTs to regulate them separately and differently than other medical devices. They just said, okay, LDTs, medical devices, we're going to remove our enforcement discretion and that's it. We're just going to regulate them as if they were another device. And that process and the way FDA did it, you know, it was very sudden announcement that they were going to propose this rule. It was jarring to the industry, because they thought they were going to get a different deal, one that they had a hand in under the VALID Act. So, and then, of course, you know, the industry thought process was, well, if we don't get the VALID Act, it's fine because FDA is still applying enforcement discretion. So it's not that big a deal if we don't get VALID. So just some additional context there.
Wow, this is fascinating. It's kind of a little bit of a soap opera, how exciting and how many changes and how many different competing interests there are throughout all this and how many different perspectives. So, Ben, what do you think is really, you know, pushing or generating the interest for FDA now to go ahead and say, hey, we want to regulate this, given the history?
I think it's fair to say that, you know, clinical labs do a lot of good work. Like they and these tests, in many cases, are legitimate. I mean, they've been fully validated, and many labs are very careful with how they design and develop these tests and make sure that they're as good as they can be before they're offered to physicians and their patients. But that said, when FDA did their analysis, and this is all in the proposed rule and the reasoning behind the proposed rule, when FDA went back and looked at a bunch of these LDTs and the information behind them, and they had a great opportunity to do that within the context of the COVID-19 pandemic, when countermeasures for the pandemic were actively sought by the government, FDA had a chance to look at a number of applications for emergency use authorization. And with certain of these applications, they found deficiencies. And I think what FDA is noting in their proposed rule is we've noted these deficiencies, and I think FDA knows that most clinical labs try to be very careful. But I think without specific rules or regulatory framework applying to LDTs, there's a lot of variability in the level of validation or the clinical utility of these tests. And so what FDA is saying is that we need standards that apply to the tests themselves to make sure that there's some oversight, that there's an agency that's checking the accuracy and the validity to make sure that everything's being done correctly. So rather than just relying on the lab to do it itself, there should be some oversight and a government agency that knows the process, knows how to apply the various testing methods, statistical methods, in order to make sure that the test is as safe and effective as it can possibly be.
It's really so interesting. And so what will it mean for laboratories, clinical laboratories who are, you know, running these LDTs and who have developed these tests moving forward? You know, if this proposed rule is finalized as the FDA has put it forward, you know, what will happen next? What will they be required to do?
Yeah, I can speak to that a little bit, Bridget. So as you alluded to, it will, you know, we'll have to see what the final rule says to be sure. But in terms of what FDA proposed, they did propose a multi-year phase out of the current enforcement discretion policy, meaning that the various medical device regulatory requirements will slowly phase in on these new entities that will be coming under their oversight. So I'm going to talk about milestones of 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, and that would be the time from when the final rule is published or becomes effective. Again, we'll see. It's most likely whenever it becomes effective. We'll see what that is when they finalize it, most likely in April of this year. But what they have said is that 1 year post-final rule, that medical device reporting requirements will come in. Those are basically the adverse event reporting requirements for devices. It's a similar concept if you've heard of adverse event reporting. And then requirements for recalls, corrections, and removals, that kind of thing. So kind of quality-related requirements at the first stage. You know, if you have a problem with your test, you have to tell FDA and potentially remove it or do a field correction, that kind of thing. Then at 2 years after the final rule is published, other medical device requirements will come into play, which include, besides the ones we just talked about, the medical device reporting and the corrections removals, the 2 year mark will trigger establishment registration and device listing requirements. Ben mentioned those earlier. They're an annual thing that device manufacturers have to comply with. In addition, labeling requirements will come into play at 2 years. This is an area that, again, we kind of touched on earlier, meaning it's going to require a little more color from FDA. Like, what is labeling for a lab developed test for something that's not, you know, packaged in a box and otherwise labeled? So we don't really know what that's going to look like yet. So again, that's going to require a little more flesh, but that labeling requirements will come into play at 2 years. And then the last thing that will come into play at 2 years is anything related to investigational use of the test. So for example, if you're doing a clinical trial to show that your test works, and it's a high-risk test, then you would be required to get what's called an IDE, an investigational device exemption, in order to do that research. So that those are the two-year requirements that would come into play. Then at 3 years, we have coming into force would be the quality system requirements. Quality systems for medical devices are essentially the equivalent of good manufacturing practices, if you've heard of those for drugs and foods and other kinds of commodities. So quality systems would come into play at 2 years. Interestingly, there is a little, again, FDA is listening to the stakeholders as much as, you know, some people think that they're not. They are listening. And one thing they've said is that if your LDT is only going to be used in your high complexity CLIA laboratory, then not all of the quality system regulations that are in the books will apply to that LDT. Again, in that circumstance, the only quality system rules would be what's called design controls, purchasing controls, acceptance activities, corrective and preventative actions, and then records requirements. If you decide, you meaning the lab, if you decide to sell your LDT or license it or have it used by other laboratories, right? So now again, it's more akin to a traditional in vitro diagnostic that other people are offering to besides your CLIA lab, then that limited subset of quality systems is not what would apply. The full panoply of quality system requirements will apply. So there's a little bit of a distinction there depending on, again, that intended use environment for the test itself. So again, that was at 3 years. And then at 3.5 years, if you have a high risk test and it's considered class 3 by FDA, that will require the pre-market application for that is called a pre-market approval application. So then at 3.5 years, if you have a class 3 test that requires a PMA, your PMA will be due at that point. And then at 4 years, if you're lower risk tests and you require what's called a pre-market notification or a 510K, your 510K will be due at that 4 year mark. What's really important, Bridget, is that FDA has also said while your applications are under review, you can continue to offer that test. So they're not saying, oh, you know, your applications need to come to us at 3.5 years and then you have to wait, you know, a year for us to respond and in the meantime, not market your tests. They are going to allow, you know, the labs to continue marketing the tests as long as they get their application in by that deadline. So that's, again, the proposed phase out of enforcement discretion / phase in of these device regulatory requirements. And we'll see, of course, if that any of that changes with the final rule.
And just to add on to that, in addition to the phase in requirements. So each phase is going to require a lab to use additional resources and extend capital in order to come into compliance. So, you know, quality systems are expensive. Compliance is kind of expensive. And so, companies that are currently regulated by FDA talk about that all the time. Like it's not an easy thing to comply with regulations. And this is a whole new regulatory framework that hasn't applied to clinical laboratories in the past. So they're not set up in the way that a device manufacturer is to be compliant with these regulations. So currently, clinical labs don't really have these kinds of resources to deal with these design controls and, you know, document record controls. They may be similar to what they're already doing, but they're not exactly the same. So there's definitely going to need to be a process of, you know, training to get everybody at these clinical laboratories aware of what the requirements are going to be. And then very likely they're going to need to bring in new resources to help them with compliance, whether it's permanent resources like, you know, a director of quality assurance and regulatory affairs, which a device manufacturer would normally have, or whether it's a consultant to come in and set everything up so that it can sort of be self-run with the resources they currently have. I mean, it's still going to take a certain amount of education and then expenditure resources to get all of these quality systems online.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even the one-year requirement, the medical device reporting, the MDRs, Bridget, I mean, that's not insignificant. As Ben said, you've got to have policies, procedures, training. You have to know what it means to be an MDR. I mean, it's not cut and dry, right? The criteria for that is if your device, you know, may have caused or contributed to a death or serious injury, or if the device malfunctioned and could malfunction again, right? And again, would cause or contribute to death or serious injury. In the context of a lab test, right, let's say a cancer test, that is going to be a really hard analysis for these labs to undertake, right? And so even the kind of earlier phasing in of requirements, the MDR, before we even get to the quality systems, they're not easy. So it is going to take a lot of work on the part of these labs and FDA. I mean, FDA is going to, they've done this with, you know, other new rules for other industries. They try really hard to do a lot of education and outreach to help, you know, to help the regulated entities really figure out what to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of work. It sounds like, you know, if you were a laboratory and you are looking for help on this, we know who to call. Joanne and Ben, you guys clearly know all that is entailed in, you know, for our laboratories to come into compliance with the new requirements. I can't wait to find out what happens. And it sounds like, you know, when I was speaking with Joanne and Ben before we started our podcast, it sounded to me like sometime in April was when we could expect to hear back on, you know, FDA's final action, if they are going to finalize the proposed rule or what will happen next. So anything else to add, Joanne, Ben, on the topic?
Yeah, I mean, April, we expect that FDA is targeting April for the final rule. We expect the FDA to publish the rule as soon as they can, you know, when they're able to meet all of the requirements of notice and comment rulemaking, which in part entails reviewing all of the comments that the agency received. And they've received thousands of comments during the comment period. So they have to review and respond substantively to those comments and then publish the notice for the final rule. So as soon as they can get the requirements done, we expect them to issue the final rule. Now, like Joanne said earlier, we do also expect that the lab industry and trade associations are going to immediately sue FDA to stop the rule from becoming effective. So, you know, we get asked this at different points. You know, after the proposed rule was published, we were getting asked this, like, do we think this is actually going to happen this time? And the answer to that is, yeah, we think it's going to happen at some point that FDA is going to be regulating LDTs in some form or fashion, whether it's through the notice and comment rulemaking, whether it's through other legislation through Congress. We do expect that at some point FDA is going to have the authority and ability to regulate LDTs. But the second question that we get asked is, when do we think this is actually going to happen? And that's a much harder question to answer. And I think the way I was asked this question before was like, well, what do we see coming up for this in 2024 and the rule applying to labs? And, you know, I've sort of had to hedge and say, well, you know, given the way things are looking, it looks like FDA is going to publish the rule and then the trade associations are going to go to court to stop the rule from becoming effective. So doesn't look like anything's really going to change from a legal regulatory applicability of the rules point of view until after all of that litigation wraps up. And, you know, who knows how long that will take. So maybe not, maybe this won't even become, maybe laboratories won't even have anything to worry about in 2024 other than pushing back against FDA. But so it could come down either way, where if the courts say that FDA does have this authority, then the rule becomes effective. And, you know, just like Joanne said, the phase in starts and, you know, the labs will have to start complying. On the other hand, if courts say that FDA does not have the authority to do this, then it stays the same for a while, but it probably goes back to Congress because there's been a lot of talk in Congress and among the various other trade associations, the labs, and then the, you know, the IVD industry saying that, you know, there's generally a consensus that something needs to be done. So that's why we're saying that, you know, it might take longer if the courts strike down FDA's rule, but it then would likely go back to Congress for some kind of action, which would happen at some point in the future.
Right. And just to add on Ben's comment about consensus, generally consensus, in January of 24, we believe, in response to some of the comments they were seeing in the docket, FDA and CMS issued a joint statement in support of this change. And so I say purportedly because of some of the comments in the docket, because some people were saying, hey, no, FDA, you shouldn't do this. CMS should just do this. CMS should expand the CLIA program to look at the clinical validity of the tests And why is FDA getting involved here? We're comfortable with CMS. You know, basically, some of the commentators kind of pushing for that as an alternative. And this joint statement from FDA and CMS essentially refutes that and says, look, CMS doesn't really have authority to evaluate the test itself. We're experts on clinical operations and personnel and ensuring that the lab itself is operating in a compliant way, but we're not qualified to assess the safety and effectiveness of the test itself. And again, the clinical utility of that, the clinical validity of that. So again, when you've got this kind of stuff in the public record, it would be extremely difficult for kind of status quo to continue, you know, and that's why, I mean, I totally agree with Ben. If the rule gets stricken down by a court, then Congress will have to do something because there's too many public statements saying that this is a problem, that status quo is no longer workable and not good for, you know, the public health and public safety.
Yeah. Say, I mean, thank you both so much for all of your time and explaining this. I personally can't wait to hear and find out what happens next and see how this all turns out for the industry. And, you know, listeners, if you have any questions for our guests today or have suggestions for topics you'd like to hear more on, please email us at healthlawdiagnosed@mintz.com. I'm Bridget Keller, and this was Health Law Diagnosed.